And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Do you really know why you do the things that you do? You probably think that you do. I think most of us think that, or at least that's how we behave most of the time, even though we've heard that Freud had this notion of unconscious motivation. In fact, he gave the illustration of an iceberg that only maybe 5% is above the surface and the remaining 95% is below the surface of consciousness in this case. And even though he was trained as a neurologist, he didn't really have the tools that exist today. For example, he didn't have the fMRI, or functional magnetic resonance imaging machine. So maybe you think you know why you do the things you do. Or maybe you think that the whole business about the unconscious is just for people with emotional problems. Well, today's guest offers a much expanded view of the unconscious using the modern tools that are available today. My guest is brain scientist David Eagleman, PhD, and he holds joint appointments in the departments of neuroscience and psychiatry at the Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. Dr. Eagleman's areas of research include time perception, vision, synesthesia, and the intersection of neuroscience and the legal system. He directs the Laboratory for Perception and Action and is the founder and director of Baylor College of Medicine's Initiative on Neuroscience and the Law. Now, I got on to Dr. Eagleman as the result of a fascinating profile of the man and his work in the New Yorker magazine, which led me to his newly released book, Incognito: The Secret Lives of the Brain. I feel fortunate to have been able to speak to this very busy and prolific scientist. Now, here's our conversation. Dr. David Eagleman, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, I am so pleased to have this opportunity to speak with you. I enjoyed your interview with Terry Gross, the profile of you, of your work in The New Yorker. And so I'm really pleased to be able to grab a bit of your time. And I've been reading your rather wonderful book, Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. So what do you mean by the secret lives of the brain?
Well, it turns out that pretty much everything your brain is doing is running under the hood of conscious awareness. Your brain is constantly performing these tremendously complex operations that you have no access to or no acquaintance with. So, you know, when you do something really simple like pick up a telephone to your ear, it's underpinned by a lightning storm of neural activity, but you don't detect any of that. And if it weren't for biology, we wouldn't even have any reason to suspect the existence of muscles or nerves or electrical signals. Because it's all totally invisible to us. And, of course, it's not just motor acts like picking up a telephone, but it's recognizing a friend's face or falling in love or making any of the decisions we do or the beliefs we have or the actions we choose to make. All of these things are underpinned by these massive operations that we're just not aware of. All we ever receive is the sort of the end product. And this is what we think of as the conscious mind, but the conscious mind, it turns out, is the smallest bit of what is happening
in the brain. Yeah, didn't Freud say something very similar to that, that we're mostly unaware of the processes that drive us?
Exactly right. You know, I went back and I did a historical analysis, and, you know, Freud's really the first person to nail this and get this idea right. There are little hints about the unconscious, starting even from St. Augustine, who realized that, you know, he had sort of a full model of how humans act and, you know, with their rational behavior. But he realized there was a little flaw in his model when people would do things like laugh suddenly at a joke or sneeze or hiccup or something that, you know, he couldn't quite explain in his model. And so he started suspecting something, but then the idea kind of got dropped for many decades. And then it got picked up sort of every 100 years. Somebody started suspecting that maybe in order to understand human behavior, we'd have to imagine that there's a part we don't have access to. But Freud was really the first person to nail that idea, and he was right. He of course, lived before the blossoming of modern neuroscience, and so we know a lot more now about the details and the possibilities there. He was you know, only able to speculate on things, and of course many of the particular ideas he had about what the subconscious represented, you know, many of those have fallen out of favor. I mean, in my view of it, I find it so weird. It's essentially that the subconscious speaks a completely alien kind of programming language that wouldn't make sense to us, even if we could understand it, as opposed to the view that the subconscious is speaking some sort of language that we get, but it's speaking in metaphor or something. I mean, it really seems like it's just a completely foreign thing going on down there. And I think in some ways it's analogous to what happens with, let's say quantum mechanics, which is the physics of what happens at the very small level, the, you know, subatomic scale.
Yeah, well, there are different levels, as you're alluding to. And I think that one level may be suitable for one kind of understanding or explanation, and another level for another. Because I know there was a section in your book on reductionism, and that'll probably take us way off in a direction that we don't need to go right now.
Okay. But yeah, that's exactly right. There are different levels, and it turns out that the fabric of reality that we come to understand, either in physics or in neuroscience, can be very distant and in some sense not even related to the sort of reality that we experience at our spatiotemporal scales, where we care about, you know, apples and rabbits and mates and rivers, and, you know, that's all that we really have evolved to care about. But it turns out that all the underlying stuff that makes that true is a totally different language.
Yes, and your book is so rich with examples of that, and one that I particularly loved was the example of the men who looked at photos of women and were asked to choose the prettiest ones. Maybe you can tell us about that experiment.
Yeah, so men were looking at these 8x10 photographs of women's faces, and what they didn't know is there were actually two sets of photographs that had the same women in them, but in one set the women's eyes had been dilated. And it turns out the men were uniformly more attracted to the women with dilated eyes. And the interesting part is that the men, none of them identified that, and none of them said, oh, well, I noticed her pupils were larger over here. But more importantly, none of the men had any conscious access to this issue that dilated eyes is a sign of sexual readiness in women. So, you know, their brains were picking up on those signals loud and clear and driving their behavior and making them think that these women were more attractive. Their brains were running these deeply embedded evolutionary programs that drove the men towards the right sort of behavior. But the men, the conscious men, had no access to what was going on. They just felt more attracted over here.
Yeah, I thought that was just a wonderful demonstration of what you're talking about. Most of us think our senses are a window to the real world, to the world outside ourselves, but that's not exactly the case, is it?
That's exactly right. When we start deconstructing what's going on out there, it becomes clear that everything you know, take vision, it's a construction of the brain. I mean, your brain is ensconced in darkness inside of your skull, and all it ever sees are electrical signals. And of course, the electrical signals that it sees that represent the information coming in through your eyes is the same electrical signals that you have coming in from your ears or your fingertips or any other part. And your brain has to take these signals, and depending on their different, you know, features and so on, it constructs vision or hearing or so on. But it's all an internal model of what you believe you're seeing out there. Just as one example that I think illustrates it easily is, you know, take the fact that your eyes are constantly jumping around the scene, and yet you don't, your vision doesn't feel the way it does when somebody is holding a jerky video camera, right? I mean, if somebody were moving a video camera around the way your eyes actually move, you'd barf. So the reason that our visual world doesn't appear to be moving around, is because all we're actually seeing is an internal model of what we believe is out there, and we're just updating that model with different information depending on where we're casting our central vision and collecting more information. But you don't need your eyes at all to see, of course. You can, when you're dreaming and your eyes are closed, you're having full, rich visual experience. And what this illustrates is that it's not even about the eyes. When your eyes are open, you're pulling in data through these two holes in your skull, and you're updating your model a little bit better, but it's essentially the same process as awake dreaming.
You know, your observation that the brain is encased in darkness within the skull seems so obvious and basic, but I have to say, I never thought of it that way before.
Yeah.
So that's kind of interesting. And you also say that vision's job is to create a useful narrative at our scale of interaction.
That's exactly right. I mean, that's all it's trying to do. I mean, this is proposed to be the basis of why we have consciousness and memory, is simply to upgrade prediction. So the whole key is we want to be better prepared the next time we come across a situation. And so we have all these mechanisms that sort of take their time and write down a story and tell us what they think just happened out there so that we'll be better prepared the next time that we come around to it. But it turns out that it's not necessarily the correct story. And of course, you know, we know that memory is quite fallible.
Yes.
Yeah, but nonetheless, it's the best job it can do.
Yeah, yeah, and also it may not really be the current story, because you say we're living in the past, because it actually takes time for our senses to send their messages to the brain, and some senses are further away than others, and so they're the, sort of these different time frames.
Exactly. This is what my lab discovered over the last 11 years or so, is this really deep problem that information gets to the brain at different speeds through different senses, and it's processed very differently. I mean, your visual system has a very different architecture than your auditory system, for example. And, you know, a signal from your big toe arrives at your brain much later than a signal from your nose. And so it turns out that the challenge the brain has to deal with is it's trying to put together this narrative about what the heck is going on in the outside world, and yet the problem it's confronted with is that the signals are streaming in at very different times. And so the only solution, this is what we've figured out over the last decade, is that the only solution is that your brain has to wait and collect up all the information and then stitch together a story about what it thinks it just saw. And the consequence is that you're living in the past. By the time you believe the moment now occurs, it's already happened a long time ago.
Yeah. You know, one of my listeners, it just so happens coincidentally yesterday, sent me an email saying he was asking various people the question, what is consciousness? And I just read your book, and I was like, oh, what did Eagleman say? I didn't quite remember. I had to come up with my own. But what is consciousness?
Well, people debate a lot about the definition, but I think it's easy to understand. It's the, you know, it's the thing that flickers to life when you wake up in the morning. So your brain is the same when you're in a deep sleep and when you're awake in the morning, but there's some different algorithm, some different software program it's running that makes you conscious now and not conscious in the middle of the night. So that's what we're talking about, is that bit of having experience, private subjective experience that's going on. That's what we mean by consciousness.
And what's the role of consciousness?
Well, I think that consciousness is essentially like the CEO of a company. So once a company reaches sufficient complexity, it needs a CEO to organize things. And that seems to be the job of consciousness, is in the same way that a CEO doesn't know about all the details of how this department actually runs and, you know, where the sockets are in the cubicles and who's doing what and how they're getting paid. And so the CEO doesn't want to know about all that, in the same way that you don't want to know about the lightning storm of neural activity when you pick up the telephone. You just want to know that it's worked. The CEO also sets the long-term goals for the company and says, okay, look, here's where I think our company needs to go over the next 5 years. And the CEO passes that mandate, and then all the rest of the machinery of the company adjusts itself to match that goal. And it takes time. But of course, this is what we do. If you say that, if you decide you want to be a better tennis player and you hire a coach, so the coach tells you all this advice, like, okay, step forward into the serve and, you know, grip your racket lower and so on. And so consciously, the CEO, the conscious you, says, okay, step forward, grip the racket lower and so on. And you do that a bunch of times. And what you're doing is you're training up the rest of the machinery of your unconscious brain. You're training all that up. You're forcing it to meet that goal, and it eventually becomes good at it. It becomes automatized, and then you no longer even have conscious access to it. You don't know how you're hitting the tennis ball. You're just doing it. And it's the same way that the CEO sets the long-term goals, and the rest of the company adjusts. And all the CEO ever really wants is just the high-level summary headlines of how things are going.
Yes, I guess that's what you meant when you wrote that consciousness is useful in limited amounts. And so it really doesn't serve us to be aware of everything down to the most minute levels and to automatize as much as can be made automatic as is useful. And also, it's interesting to reflect that how much is going on around us that our senses don't even pick up on. For example, we're both probably bathed in radio waves and TV waves and gamma radiation and who knows what else. And it's not even fitting into the picture of our internal experience.
Exactly right. So all that stuff, the radio waves and TV and cell phone, all that is electromagnetic radiation, which is exactly what visible light is. What we call visible light is just a very small slice of that spectrum of electromagnetic radiation, but it just so happens that we have biological receptors that can detect that stuff. So we treat that very specially, and we think that represents reality. But as it turns out, the part of the spectrum that we call visible light is only 1/10 billionth of the spectrum. So most of the stuff happening, we don't have biological receptors for, and so we would have no reason to even suspect its existence if it weren't for the building of machines and the understanding of physics and so on.
Okay, well, talking about consciousness, where does attention fit in? There's some kind of tight relationship there, I think, between consciousness and attention. How would you describe that?
I think what attention is the thing that pulls, it's the thing that pulls more detail into your internal model. Mm-hmm. So for example, let's say you're looking at a scene in front of you, you're not actually seeing most of the details, even though they're sitting right on your retina. But if I were to ask you, okay, well, what exactly is the color of your coffee mug? Then you can turn your eyes to that, and attention is this process of saying, okay, I'm going to now pull that detail into my internal model, even though it wasn't there a moment ago. But similarly, if I were to ask you the position of your tongue in your mouth right now, you could answer that question, but you weren't aware of it a moment ago. You attend to it. You pay attention to it, and that's how that becomes part of what you're aware of.
And now I'm gagging on my tongue once I become aware of it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, then I won't start talking about blinking or breathing because those are really terrible.
Right.
Yeah. But it turns out that when the company is running itself perfectly, the CEO doesn't need to know anything. If the CEO's got everything set up so things are going perfectly, you don't need any action out of the CEO. In other words, when you're driving to work and it's just a normal morning, you're essentially not very conscious of what's going on because you don't need to be. And what happens is it's only when there's a violation of your expectations that attention comes online and feeds information to consciousness. So it's only when suddenly something's different or there's an overturned car in front of you or something, then suddenly you're attending to that because it's a violation of your expectations and you have conscious awareness of that situation.
What's the relationship between attention and memory?
Interesting question. It turns out there's at least two different forms of memory. And so normal memory is a function of what you're attending to. So it is possible to get stuff into the system without even attending to it, but that's sort of a more rare thing that happens. Normally, what you remember are the things that you paid attention to. If you didn't pay attention to the number of cracks on the sidewalk this morning, then it's unlikely you're going to have any memory of that. But it turns out that when something is really salient. It's really emotionally salient, let's say a car accident. Then you are attending to that with a completely different level of focus, and there's another part of your brain that comes online and lays down memory on a secondary memory track. And this is the amygdala comes online, and you're essentially laying down memories in a different way that are unerasable. So these are the memories of post-traumatic stress mm-hmm. disorder.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And what about meditation and mindfulness as tools for developing more awareness of some of these underlying processes?
Well, I'm a big proponent of meditation and mindfulness. I've noticed in the literature and even in discussion that no one ever has anything bad to say about these things, and I think that's appropriate. Right. I mean, you know, everything else is debated, right? Should you have carbs or protein or not? but not meditation and mindfulness. These seem to be just really good things. And in fact, a colleague of mine in Germany is trying to get legislation passed to make meditation mandatory for all elementary school students
mm-hmm.
because you know, he argues that it's an important part of the brain toolkit. And you don't get a user's guide to your brain. But in fact, especially in this era, everybody's trying to get your attention with advertisement and internet and text messages and so on. And he argues that what children need more than ever now is a way of just being able to turn inward and not be so reactive to the outside world. And this is what meditation gives you, is an ability to sort of see the outside world, but not be as reactive to it. Every time the text message dings, you know, it changes your trajectory for the next minute. Now that said, I do think that even people who are expert meditators, they're getting slightly down deeper into their unconscious, but I don't think it's very far at all. I think they're essentially just dipping their toes in the water. They're doing a lot better than the rest of us, but in fact, you know, these are such vast waters and deep caverns that I think they're not actually getting that far, because as I said at the beginning, I don't actually think we would even understand the language down there.
Yes. Now, one of the things that you spend a fair amount of time on is the idea of multiple selves that were, again, going back to the subtitle of the book, The Secret Lives of the Brain, that there are these sort of autonomous subsystems and subroutines that are running sort of beneath the surface of consciousness. And I was wondering about the possible relationship to things like multiple personality, automatic writing, channeled personalities, you know, some of that far out stuff.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting part about the multiple selves is that, you know, the only way to really think about the brain is to think about you've got these competing networks that are always battling it out in the brain to control your behavior. And this is because evolution doesn't sort of come up with one solution and stop there, but she is constantly, chronically reinventing solutions to things. And so it turns out that you end up with all these different parts of your brain, and it's just like a neural parliament where there you have different political parties that are fighting it out to control the ship of state, to steer where things are going. And you don't have any central leader that, you know, makes these decisions about the parliament. Instead, it's that they debate until they come to some sort of solution. And so as a result, people can argue with themselves and feel conflicted with themselves and contract with themselves and cajole themselves. And I think, you know, this gives us a much more nuanced view of who we are when you realize that you're not one thing, you're more like a multiplicity. And you know, sometimes people look back on their behavior and they think, how could I have been the one to do that? Well, the answer is you are not one thing. As Walt Whitman correctly surmised, he said, I am large, I contain multitudes, and that's exactly right.
Well, there are people who report, for example, writing whole books that they claim it really wasn't them, it just came through them. Do you think there might be some kind of a subsystem that's spun off that's coming
yeah.
from?
I mean, okay, so here's what I think. I think it's a little bit of an exaggeration when people say they wrote things without having any participation in them. but it is the case that all of our ideas are served up from these subterranean caverns, and we don't know where these ideas come from, right? So, you know, pay attention to it next time you have a good idea and you say, oh, I'm a genius. I just had an idea that I'll invite so-and-so to be on my show. Well, it wasn't really you that thought of it, right? I mean, your brain's been working on this for hours or weeks or months. It's been consolidating information. You've seen that speaker before. You've got to, you know, at some point, your brain puts it together and serves it up, and then you take credit for it. But it's not clear who the credit actually belongs to. I mean, it belongs to you as a person with a brain, but it doesn't necessarily belong to your conscious mind.
Right. I totally identify with that. What do we learn from the example of Charles Whitman, the former Eagle Scout and high IQ bank teller who shot and killed 48 people from the University of Texas Tower in Austin?
Well, he had detected that things were changing inside of him for about a year. He was writing in his diary about this. He went to see a psychiatrist about this. He felt like something was changing inside of him. And he wrote in his suicide note the night before he went up on the Texas Tower and shot everybody. He said, when this is all over, I want an autopsy to be performed. And that's exactly what happened. And it turned out he had a brain tumor. And it was, this brain tumor had been growing and pressing against a part of his brain called the amygdala, which is involved in fear and aggression. And so, there are hundreds of cases like this. It turns out, of course, when your brain changes, you change. And if you get a brain tumor, which is, of course, not something any of us would choose to get, that can change your behavior. And it leads us straight into the heart of these very deep questions about culpability, right?
Yes.
Because Whitman didn't choose to get a brain tumor, and yet this is what happened. And, of course, Whitman is not a one-off example. There's so many. I cite another case in my book also about this guy who, at 40 years old, started becoming a pedophile. And he started collecting child pornography, and he eventually made an inappropriate move on his prepubescent stepdaughter. And his wife had him arrested. And the night before his sentencing, he was having these terrible headaches. And he finally went to get a scan, and it turned out he had a massive frontal lobe tumor. So they did an emergency surgery on him. They removed the tumor, and his sexual behavior returned completely to normal. And then about 6 months later, he started becoming a pedophile again. And he went back to the neurologist. It turns out the surgeons had missed a section of the tumor, which was now regrowing. And they resected the tumor a second time, and then his behavior returned completely to normal. So this is just another illustration of hundreds that you are your brain. And the reason this becomes so difficult about these issues of culpability is because we're naturally very retributive. We say, okay, look, if you did this thing, then you deserve the punishment. But who's the you? If things change in your brain and it wasn't your choice, does it still make sense to punish you in the same way? So what I argue for in the book is a forward-looking legal system, which is to say, instead of imagining that all brains are created equal and have the equal capacity for decision-making and so on, and therefore it's okay to punish everybody equally, instead a forward-looking legal system takes a very different approach and says, look, what do we do with the person from here? Is there anything that we can do to help? And if not, how can we modulate sentencing based on future dangerousness? So in other words, you do risk assessments on people. Some people, I mean, brains are not created equal. Some people are very dangerous and need to be taken off the streets for a long time. At the other end of the spectrum, some people are not very dangerous and they ended up in some situation that's very unlikely to repeat. And so, a tailored, customized legal system will be one in which we treat people as individuals. We try to understand what's going on with their brains, if there's anything we can do to help them. And if there's not, we sentence them appropriately instead of imagining that there's sort of a one-size-fits-all solution in terms of incarceration of fixed prison terms. This is not only more humane and neurocompatible, but it's also a lot more cost-effective.
Well, this fits in with one of the themes of the book, which is essentially that we're not driving the bus. In other words, the thing that we identify with the I, when I say me, and you talk about things like rabies and narcotics and genes and brain injuries, which you just talked about, and toxins and diseases. I particularly like the rabies example. Maybe you could just quickly touch on that.
Yeah, I mean, rabies has always been one of my favorite examples, which is, you know, so essentially you get bitten, and the rabies virus works its way up your nerves, up into your central nervous system, up to your brain. And once it's there, it goes to a couple of different places. It goes to your areas of your temporal lobe, one of the lobes of your brain, and it also goes to your salivary glands. And what it does in your temporal lobe is it essentially controls your behavior and makes you more aggressive and more prone to bite somebody. And it's positioned itself in your salivary gland so that when you bite somebody, it passes itself on. I mean, this is crazy, but this is how rabies gets into wild animals and passes itself to the next wild animal. And the reason it's so remarkable is because what it's doing is this very tiny little thing is controlling a creature billions of times larger than it. It's like it's stepping into the cockpit and driving this creature around. I just have always found that an amazing thing, but you know, that's from the point of view of the rabies. We get to see how it jumps into the cockpit and passes itself on that way. But from the point of view of us, what it makes very obvious and clear is that, you know, is that we are able to be controlled. We've got all these lock and key mechanisms in our brain, and all it takes is something getting in there, and then we become a very different kind of person. We become aggressive.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's like the Transformers or Iron Man, that somebody gets inside there and control this very large, very large person.
Exactly.
And, well, I know you're short on time. You've just come off a 30-day book tour. And and I know you've got a lot that you're trying to catch up on. I would really love to talk to you at greater length. As we wind down here, is there anything that you'd like to add?
Well, I mean, I you know, just to finish off the neuro law thing, I just think that this is one of the real directions that neuroscience is going, is in navigating our social policy. I think that neuroscience is at a point where it can really, in a meaningful way, step out of the laboratory and change the way that we run our societies. And there's no reason that social policy should not be run as rigorously as we do scientific experiments, where we base it on data and you know, every once in a while somebody will say to me, gosh, don't you think that sounds creepy to bring science into, let's say, sentencing decisions? And the important question always is, compared to what? Yeah. The way it stands now, you know, ugly people get much longer sentences than pretty people because there are all these extra legal influences that go on. So, you know, if we brought data to the table and saw who's actually the ones who go off and commit more crime, and understanding the biological basis of behavior and understanding what can go wrong with people's brains and so on, and how we might help them, that seems to me like a much more enlightened way to run a legal system.
Well, that certainly makes sense to me. I support it strongly. Dr. David Eagleman, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Dr. David Eagleman. I really would have liked to have been able to spend more time with him. Somehow, his people had blocked out only a half hour for our interview instead of the 40 to 50 minutes I generally shoot for. Consequently, there were a number of questions we just didn't have time for. So you'll just have to get his book, Incognito. I can't recommend it too highly. Not only is he a cutting-edge neuroscientist, he's also a very gifted writer. Before becoming a brain scientist, he tried his hand at becoming a screenwriter and also a stand-up comedian. I really wanted to explore that phase of his life as well. I mentioned the comedy thing after our interview was over, and he laughingly said something along the lines of being glad our time had run out. Being a big fan of stand-up and having fantasized about doing it when I was younger, I would have loved to hear some of his stories about that period of his life. I would have liked to have had time to press him harder on my question about such phenomena as multiple personality, automatic writing, and channeled personalities. I felt like he slid away from those a bit. I also think he might have had interesting things to say about dreams and about self-hypnosis. Although they are no substitute for the book, you can find Terry Gross's interview with him on the NPR Fresh Air site, as well as in the NPR podcast area on iTunes for the May 31st, 2011 interview. The New Yorker story about him is called The Possibilian, and it appeared in the April 25th, 2011 issue, and you can find it online.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick. You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
Happy Friday, everyone. Assuming you're listening to this on the day it comes out, that is. I'm still in my weekly mode, catching up to all the interviews I've previously conducted. I got carried away working ahead, in part just because there's so many good people to interview and my mania for doing it, and also so that I'd be free to take a summer vacation if the opportunity presented itself. I guess my trip to the Second World Congress on Positive Psychology was the vacation. And I'm still getting over the cold I picked up on that trip, which, as so often happens for me, seems to have settled in my voice box. So if my voice sounds a bit off, that's why. At least that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Hey, I discovered something last night that got me a bit excited. Jonathan, one of my sons, has been listening to selected Shrink Wrap Radio episodes on his iPhone while driving in his car. And he's been using the Stitcher app, which I've mentioned in the past, and he mentioned to me that he wished he could hear my interview with Temple Grandin. Evidently, Stitcher only lets you listen to a few of the most recent episodes, and the Grandin interview was no longer available on Stitcher. Well, here's the exciting part, at least to me. I had been under the impression that you wouldn't be able to listen to the audio by going to the shrinkwrapradio.com website because it uses a flash player, and iPhones, iPods, and iPads simply can't handle the flash format. Just for the heck of it, I thought I'd try it anyway on both my iPad and then on my iPhone, and lo and behold, the audio played anyway. Evidently, it automatically opens up the MP3 file in another browser window on whatever iDevice you're using. However, it takes a bit of time, so you have to be patient. It might take 15 or 20 seconds before this happens. Now, maybe some of you out there already knew this, but it was news to me. So if you have an iDevice, in addition to being able to subscribe to Shrink Wrap Radio and listen to it in iTunes or on the Stitcher app, you can also just navigate to shrinkwrapradio.com in your iPhone or iPad or iPod browser and click on the play button there. Of course, the other gratifying thing for me around this episode is that my adult son wants to listen to these podcasts, and he tells me how impressed and proud he is of me and what I'm doing here. That feels very good, as I'm sure you can imagine. By the way, I put up a new post on my Psychology Today blog, if you haven't seen it. The easiest way to find it is just to Google The Happiness Dispatch. This latest blog entry is titled Declare Your Love, Overcoming the Fear of Saying I Love You, and it was triggered by something Dr. Barbara Fredrickson said in her address at that Positive Psychology conference in Philadelphia. It's pretty quick reading, and it might strike a chord in you. Post a comment there if it does. Well, talk about it's all in your mind. That's certainly the case with the stock markets, which have just taken a big dive around the world. The stock market is a very psychological phenomenon, and right now it's being driven by panic. Well, I'm here to invite you to challenge the social contagion by going the other direction and demonstrating your faith in the future by making a donation to Shrink Wrap Radio. Your $5 or $10 a month donation will help keep the economy from stagnating, and the daring confidence that you show in doing so will boost your spirits and mine. Just click on the big green donate button at shrinkwrapradio.com and join our small but growing band of optimistic contrarians.
Hello and welcome. My name is Dr. Madan Kataria from India. I'm the People call me Laugh Doctor or Giggling Guru. Right now, I'm with on the couch with Dr. Dave. I forgot.
Yes, Dr. Matan Kataria, the Laughter Doctor, will be my guest on the next episode. More about that later. In the meanwhile, here are some recent emails from our listener community. And the first one is from listener John Conway, who in part writes, "Hello, David. You do a great job of lining up interesting guests, including a fair number of heavy hitters. So it is with some diffidence that I offer a suggestion you may not have considered. A clinical psychologist named Kathy McMahon. Kathy has a website, and you'll find her website at peakoilblues.org. He goes on to say, the name says it all. Her emphasis is to help people who have become aware of the ugly ramifications of peak oil to deal with the emotional aftermath and develop a positive plan. And then he gives me a link to a 20-minute interview with Kathy recorded after a speech in Vancouver, and it gives a good summary. And you can find that 20-minute interview. I did listen to it. It's quite good. And you'll find it at ecoshock.org. And if you poke around there, I'm sure you'll turn it up. I skip a bunch of his email here to continue with the theme of Kathy McMahon. He says, Kathy McMahon gives a number of speeches and interviews, so she may well be amenable to a conversation with you if you're interested. Most of her interviews are with people from organizations that are concerned with resource issues or financial disaster. Your approach emphasizing the psychological aspects would be a new and worthy contribution to the discussion, I think. If you decide to pursue this and I can be of any assistance, please let me know. And he signs it, best wishes, John Conway. John, it's synchronistic that just yesterday afternoon, I met with a local organization, Climate Protection for Sonoma County, and they're hoping to roll this out nationwide. And I met with them about pro bono market research work that I'm offering to do for them. So you've made a good suggestion here, and it certainly aligns with my own values. I don't know if I'll get around to interviewing Molly or not, but at any rate, I've turned the audience on to the interview that you have suggested. Moving right along, next we hear from Molly, who responded to my thanks for her donation. And she writes, hi, David. You're very welcome. Thanks for taking the time to write a personal note. I was moved by your eloquent and humble requests for assistance, as well as my gratitude for the great podcast. I'm a recently graduated psych major from Denison University. While I so enjoyed my various psych classes, I decided to shift modes for a while and am currently interning at an organic farm. I already miss the immersion in psychology I experienced as a student, so the Shrink Wrap podcasts are a wonderful way to stay engaged, and I'm learning a lot. Keep up the good work. Thanks for what you're doing. And that's from Molly. And Molly, I remember when I was in Italy doing a workshop with my friend Ron Alexander, and we were staying on an organic farm there in Italy, and there were a couple of interns from Australia, and we had a delightful time speaking with them and learning about their lives. So I'm sure it's good for you to be working the soil. That's good for the soul. Finally, this next one comes to us all the way from Greenland. I'm not sure I was aware that I had a listener in Greenland, so this is particularly gratifying. And he writes, dear Dr. Dave, thank you for sharing your talent and your continuous efforts. Though books are necessary to get a lot of details, I've learned through listening that the dialogue sticks better in my mind. It keeps me interested and motivated and is such a good way of learning. As much as I love listening to the episodes, I still love books. I'll give you some examples of the connection between your guests and me getting their books and close off with two suggestions, one for your website and one for a future guest. After listening to your interview with Barry Krakow, episode number 248, I think it's Barry Krakow, I mispronounced that. He says, I was very sensitive to sleeping problems in general, but especially my own. The fact is that I've had problems or problematic relationship to sleep as long as I can remember. I immediately recommended Barry Krakow's book to my mother when she mentioned that she was having difficulty sleeping. She ordered the book through Amazon.com with fast shipping, and it soon arrived here in Nuuk, Greenland. Obviously, I was interested in lending the book, as she, after a few days of reading and doing suggested exercises, has experienced dramatic improvement. Instead of lending me her book, she ordered a new one for me. I read it and have benefited in the form of better sleep. I don't think I would have gotten to Krakow's book without listening to your show, so thank you. Your episode number 142 with Jonathan Haidt is one of my absolute favorites. I've listened to the episode countless times. Recently, I was given the happiness hypothesis by a friend as a gift that bought one for herself as well while ordering. I'm now enjoying reading Jonathan's book. Again, thanks. As you see, you've had an impact on my reading list. I looked at your website but didn't find that you benefit from this. That's a shame. I suggest that you try to benefit from this by becoming a bookseller affiliate, for example, at Amazon. Your affiliate code ought to make it onto your website's right-hand side with a general link, the book or books you mention for each episode, a page with your top 25 recommended readings. I've noticed that you have listeners from all around the world, Afghanistan, Australia. I think you'll benefit from affiliate partners that sell worldwide, and especially books and audio/video recordings. It can be time-consuming to go back and edit the show notes, but I'm sure one of your trusted listeners could help you out there. With full disclosure of your relation to the affiliate partner, there's no problem whatsoever doing this. The quality of your shows is a witness to this. When my savings allows me, I'll be buying the Red Book of C.G. Jung. I'll be looking for a click-through at your website before I order, I promise. One guest that I personally would like to hear in Shrink Wrap Radio is the British Paul McKenna. I saw his TV shows back in the 1990s when he hypnotized members from an audience in the classical entertaining show style. He has since gone into NLP and self-help. This will turn the red lights on, but he has also gotten a PhD degree since then. I think both his and your humor and experience in talking to an audience could shed a light into the mechanics and effectiveness of hypnotism. I am aware of episode number 141 with Nancy Hunter, which matches the topics of my suggestion, and your hypnosis tag on your website lists also episode number 162 and 164. It really helps, though, to get into the same topic from different angles. And then he goes on to give a link to Dr. Paul McKenna's profile and some articles about him. And I did check out one interview online with Paul McKenna, and I agree, he would make a very interesting guest. I'm not sure how I would get through to him without an email address, however. And that's signed, best regards, Aputsiak Janusen in Nuuk, Greenland. And I'm sure I butchered the pronunciation, and I apologize for that. Aputsiak, thanks for the suggestion about providing Amazon links. I'll have to revisit the idea of providing those affiliate links. I actually used to do that in the early days of the show, but found that the returns were so small that it just didn't seem worth the time it was taking for me to create the links. However, as a result of your email, it occurred to me that there might be WordPress tools, WordPress being the tool that I use to put these shows up, that there might be WordPress tools that I could use that might make the process somewhat easier. I have found that there are a number of such tools available, but I'll need to see if I can figure out which one would be best and also how to set it up. I do know that these interviews lead to listeners buying books, and if I could have an actual paying sponsor for the show, my first choice would be a bookseller. I like your idea of a volunteer helping out to post links to books. I still have an Amazon affiliate code. I'm not sure how I could use a volunteer on this task, but if there is someone out there who's fairly computer literate who'd like to volunteer for this task, well, please let me know. So I think that better wrap it up for today. As always, send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to Dr. David Eagleman for sharing his work on the secret lives of the brain. As you heard earlier, my guest on the next episode will be Dr. Madan Kataria of Bangalore, India. Perhaps you've seen the YouTube video featuring John Cleese and Dr. Kataria, or maybe you saw him on Oprah or read about him in Time magazine. At any rate, be prepared to laugh along with us. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.